You're listening to Give Me World Order, episode 43 of season 14. Hey everybody, my name is Klaatu and I'm back in New Zealand. That is back after a trip to the United States to North Carolina, Raleigh, to be specific, for the All Things Open conference. It's a pretty neat conference. I gave a talk there about Flatpak. Thanks especially to Alexi, who emailed me back in February, I think, of this year, a couple of times with great information about Flatpaks and really kind of got me started really looking even deeper into Flatpak than I had in the first place. So he doesn't know it, but and he may not hear this. I don't know if he's listening right now, but thank you, Alexi. That was very, very helpful information. I benefit a lot from this show from people's feedback, and I feel a little bit selfish sometimes because I feel like I'm learning so darn much from everyone who emails me, and then I don't know that I really have the opportunity to acknowledge that all the time. I mean, you as listeners can email me. That's easy. Decentralized targeting a centralized entity. That's pretty simple. But for me to express gratitude to you is a little bit dicier because it would be, I guess, difficult to fully express that to each and every one of you who has ever contacted me in any way. So I'm doing it now. I'm saying thank you for talking back to this show and teaching me all manner of things, really. So that is sort of over. The All Things Open conference is over. And it was a really good conference. I learned a heck of a lot. There are so many talks there that it's one of those embarrassment of wealth, I guess. You go there, and this happens at every conference, obviously. There are just so many tracks, so many talks to listen to, and half the time I find it almost easier in a way to just find a room and camp out in it. And that way you don't have to make any choices. It just all happens for you. It might not be the best choice. You might not be getting all the talks that you really want to hear, but when faced with so much choice, sometimes it's almost easier to just make no choice and just randomly select a comfortable room with a power supply nearby and camp out there all day. And that is one of the ways that I've been able to get a really good diverse sampling of what's available at different conferences. Now, this time I was actually working the conference. I was at a booth, so I didn't get a chance to see really probably half of the talks that I would love to see, but still, very good conference, highly recommended. Okay, so that's good, that's over with. I'm back in New Zealand, so my schedule, in theory, will start to stabilize a little bit, not that you necessarily knew that my schedule had not stabilized. I kept up with the episode pretty effectively, which is great. But what I do want to do is catch up on listener feedback, and some of you may have noticed that I've not been great at responding to all the listener feedback. I mean, I've tried to respond at least nominally, but there are a couple that slipped through the cracks. So I want to talk about some of those right now. One of them is from Robert, and Robert says, he says, I run nothing but open source software. Do I qualify? Oh, that's funny. So he says, I run nothing but open source software. And then he did a joke that doesn't really, it won't translate well if I just read it out loud here. So it was cute. And he says, I have a Raspberry Pi attached to my TV, which is state-of-the-art, but I've got the internet disabled as I value my privacy, and I don't trust it, as I figure it probably reports back everything I watch to LG, who I do not know. So instead, I have an old Pi, which is painfully slow, running OSMC for Kodi. Within this, I use MB, that's EMBY, which I've actually never heard of, to stream and transcode content from my workhorse, which is the home-built i3 system that I recycled from old parts I had lying around, but it does the job. That's pretty cool. This is Klaatu again. It sounds pretty, pretty patchwork, but that's pretty freaking cool. And then he says, the workhorse is running Mint 19.2, and this machine, in addition to being used as an MB server, EMBY server, is basically where I design and generate G code for products I intend selling in the not too distant future. I mostly design an Inkscape for 2D objects, with plans to further my understanding of FreeCAD for 3D, and the G code I generate is generated through G code tools, but mostly I use PartCAM, as I find it quick and easy for G-code generation, but does But it does have its quirks. For simulation, I use Kamotix. That's KAMOTICS. For 3D G-code generation, I will probably use PyPM, as I have had success in the past. The business machine that controls the CNC via parallel port is an HP Compaq P4. I think I paid 40 British pounds, which was still too much, as every OS I've run on it has been so slow, even with SSD. Wow. Initially, I was running Linux CNC on Debian 7, then switched to 9, then Mint Mate, or Mate. I've just recently managed to get Linux CNC running on top of Linux MX, which I'm surprised no one else has thought of, as I couldn't find a guide, and I will be sticking with this setup as it's perfect, with no issues so far. It's currently installed on HDD as a test. If it proves its worth, then it will be installed to the SSD. I intend to buy another CNC machine if my business takes off, and will be running this off GRBL on Arduino once I have, or will recycle a Pi for Universal G-Code Sender, or I could just buy another parallel port card and run from the single PC. Oh, and there are two new websites I am operating, both using WordPress with the images designed in both Inkscape and GIMP. I've used literally thousands of open source software over the years, some of which have gained traction, others which have died off. My reason for sticking with open source is simple: cost. Since they are free, there is no barrier to entry. I learned my lesson. As a kid, I used to spend fortunes buying PC Mag just for the free software, only to suffer buyer's remorse when I found the software was usually no good. Older versions of commercial software given away for free, crippled with adverts and a lack of functionality. I think it was at this point I started looking for alternatives. The beauty is, if there is a commercial product available with a highly sought-after feature, then it's only a matter of time before it makes its way over to the open source community. So all you need is patience. So I think this is a fantastic little story, and this is kind of exactly what I wanted to hear about. You know, these origin stories for Linux users. I think it's endlessly fascinating to find out how people get to the place of using Linux in a serious and dedicated way. And I think on one hand, there are lots of similar, you know, it all kind of boils down to, I don't know, the same 3 or 4 or 8 basic elements, one of them or a combination of them. But the decoration around that is often quite unique and really interesting to hear how people got to that place. And I think with a lot of them, you can kind of see yourself in the story as well. You kind of, you see something that you can identify with, which is fascinating. I mean, even this story, buying PC Magazine, looking for the free software on the bundled disks. Not everyone will have had that experience necessarily. But for those of us who have, it's quite familiar, that feeling of standing in the store thinking, okay, I'm going to spend $20 or $25 or whatever it is to get this magazine because I see that it comes bundled with some software, and that software really seems like what I need to further my career or to learn that trick that I want to use on my next project or whatever it may be. And you're thinking and really hoping that you're getting somehow a good deal because you know that similar software off the shelf normally is going to cost you $300, and you just can't afford that. So you go and you get this magazine, and you're really hoping that somehow the little demo app on the disk is going to be good enough to get you through what you need to learn. And inevitably, it's either something that, well, you know, that someone has valued appropriately. In other words, it's something that's not very good, and so they feel fine about giving it away on a disc on a magazine, or it's stripped of many of its features because they know that, or the idea is that you'll fall in love with some aspects of the software and then decide, okay, well, I can spend, I'll have to spend $300 and so on, and ultimately it just kind of ends in this sort of contentious, resentful feeling for the software that kind of seemed to be promising, but in the end only disappointed you. And no one leaves that deal very happy. And yet, many of us kept coming back to those magazines, thinking that maybe this one will have the stuff that I need. And it just it was never a super satisfying feeling for many of us. And I'm sure there are exceptions. There were good things about a lot of those magazines, and there were things that we discovered from those magazines that did work out, and so on. And I'm sure that you could also say the same thing of open source stuff. You know, I mean, you could buy a magazine and get open source software on the CD and ultimately be disappointed at the features that it didn't have, or the way that it worked that you weren't that wasn't familiar to you, or whatever the case may be. So there's, you know, frustration and trying to find that right tool is a shared experience. We've all been there, whether it's from a magazine that you bought off the shelf or a site that you found through way too much research and finally downloaded the thing and only to discover that it's just not what you need, or you just can't get your mind around it, or whatever. But when it's closed source and you're spending money on it and it's disappointing, it kind of hurts a little bit more because it's separated you from something that you've worked for. And speaking of money, I think that part of the problem here is that the closed source software, we're talking about money. There is literally, as Robert says, a barrier to entry. There's a hard barrier to entry. There is no negotiation, really. This is a product, and you are expected to pay for the product. And no matter how much the company claims to really just want to surprise and delight you and to make your life better and to improve your family relationships and all the other wonderful things that companies claim to be the very reason for their own existence, ultimately it is simply a business deal. It is something that you give them money for the product and they give you the product. And if you cannot continue to pay for the product, either for the updates or nowadays literally for a subscription service half the time, then you don't have access to that product anymore. They're not that concerned about your family relationships. They're only concerned about it as long as you can pay. And there's something kind of revealing in that, and a little bit disappointing to say the least. And so the open source methodology is it's kind of nice because the sentiment is real. The sentiment that we actually do want you to have this software, that's like real, because if you do pay for it at all, you literally bought the code. You have the thing. You have all of the stuff that you need. I think a great example of that is Slackware. Yes, I'm biased, but Slackware, you pay your $49 or whatever it is for the DVD. You get sent the DVD, or you download it from the internet, and you have everything that you need to essentially re-implement Slackware. You've got all the build scripts. You've got all the source code. You've got everything that went into building the product. Then you own it forever. If the software industry shuts down tomorrow, you have that. You have the OS and everything required to build that OS right there on the DVD. There are exceptions to that. There's a guy who's building Slackware from source on linuxquestions.org. It's quite interesting to follow along with his progress. And there are snags here and there where in order to build it, you kind of need to build it on an existing Slackware. It's one of those weird things where apparently it's really hard to do if you're not, I mean, like literally building it from scratch is difficult to do. So there are some quirks here and there, but the point being that you've got the full, you've got the bootable OS, and then you've got the tools that you need to re-implement. And that's huge. It's a big deal, and it's really, really remarkable that open source is able to provide that. And to me, it's remarkable that people are able to resist that. For me, that's such a key feature of open source, that you own the software and that you're only paying for what you get forever. You pay once and then you own the thing forever. Whereas really, when you turn that around, I think there's no other way for the relationship to go but toward resentful. I just don't understand how you could ever appreciate closed source software after paying for the product and then seeing that the company doesn't actually care about your level of success with that product. At least with open source, at least if no one cares about it, then that is stated. And for someone to care about it, you can throw money at someone, at some consultant somewhere, to help you through something. It's not always a smooth process. Not everyone has that set up, but it does exist. And there are independent consultants out there. who are as open source as anyone else, right? I mean, there's no, as I've said in episode 1337, there's no centralized authority in open source. So anyone who knows it can be the expert to help you through your next project. And I mean, I myself have made a fair amount of money doing exactly that. So there you go. So thanks, Robert. That was a very thoughtful and insightful origin story. I really enjoy reading that sort of thing. I think it's endlessly fascinating. Okay, and I have another one here from DeepGeek, and DeepGeek largely told me what I already know, which is that there's a website out there called catb.org. That's catb.org/jargon. That's the jargon file. It's by Eric S. Raymond, and here's what DeepGeek said. Several episodes ago, you discussed the term magic cookies on one of your The New World Order episodes, and I thought about emailing a link to you for the jargon file, aka the Hacker Dictionary, as I thought it would be helpful. I should have done that. It seems you are covering similar ground as Eric S. Raymond has. Raymond is the current maintainer of the jargon file, and it can be browsed here. That's catv.org/jargon. Since he has his HTML source online, I used to make it to make an EPUB with Caliber. If you want it, I can send you a copy, but it's quite large. He also published How to Be a Hacker at catb.org/tilde/esr/facts/hacker-how-to.html, which seems very pertinent to your last episode. And I think my last episode in context of this email would have been 1337, actually. So, yeah, I mean, I knew about the CatB jargon file that I've referenced before. I'm sure of it. And it is a good one. Yes, I agree. It's an important one to kind of keep tabs on, not necessarily because it represents any kind of authoritative ruling on anything at all, but it does represent a history. And that's something. And it is a history. It is the history as written by, I don't know, whoever started the jargon file, and then obviously lately by Eric S. Raymond, who is maintaining it. So it's history based on his, or on their, on the people who wrote it, on their experience and on their view of things, and that's really a valid thing to keep track of. I think it's quite interesting. The How to Be a Hacker document rings true. This is really good stuff. I think I feel like I have probably read this before. It feels vaguely familiar, and this is very much in the vein of what was that book by Michael Gian. I'm not thinking the name, but it's Linux and the Unix Philosophy is the title of the book, and I don't have it in front of me, so I can't think of the dude's. Mike, I can see the name in my head, and I can't seem to spit it out. But anyway, it's a great book. You should read it. And it's a little bit, in a way, similar to this. Only this is more focused, I guess, on really sort of generic hacking rather than specifically Linux and the Unix philosophy. But it's got H2s like the world is full of fascinating problems waiting to be solved. No problem should ever have to be solved twice. Boredom and drudgery are evil. Freedom is good. Attitude is no substitute for competence, and so on. So it kind of goes on like that. And it's, if you look at it, I mean, there are some things that are a little bit maybe too specific to, I mean, anything saying, well, here's how to do this thing is obviously, especially in open source, I mean, there's no way for it to truly sort of encompass all of our feelings on the subject. So there are some things here that probably get a little bit too specific for everyone to say, yes, this is me, and this is exactly my answer to that question. But it is nevertheless a really good document that kind of sums up a bunch of similar thoughts, I think, about the question of, well, how can I be a hacker? How can I become a hacker? That sort of thing. I mean, even this, like, how do I tell if I'm already a hacker? Ask yourself the following three questions. Do you speak code fluently? Do you identify with the goals and values of the hacker community? Has a well-established member of the hacker community ever called you a hacker? If all three of those questions can be answered as yes, you are already a hacker. no two alone are sufficient. I just feel like that's a little bit, I feel like that's, as a well-established member of the hacker community, ever called you a hacker? Well, how do you ensure that? Do you have to just ask them outright, will you please call me a hacker now? I mean, like, that feels weird to me. But either way, the file's interesting. It's a good read. You should probably read it. So that's at catb.org. It's an interesting site to kind of crawl around on. It's got a lot of stuff to it. I think that's all the listener feedback that I'm actually behind on. I've got a couple of others here, but they're not necessarily all that interesting to read. I mean, because they're very directly to me and require an answer from me, and it's not really of general interest. So, yeah, I think that's everything. I think that's everyone I forgot. I'm probably forgetting somebody somewhere off of Mastodon or something, but ideally I've responded to them privately anyway. So, let's take a coffee break, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about coffee. Ideally, you have coffee right now and are enjoying it. I wanted to talk about a site called freesvg.org, and this is kind of close to home for me because I wasted several days of my time kind of dealing with the fallout from what this freesvg thing solves. So very specifically, there was a website, and I was a pretty ardent supporter of this website, and it was called openclipart.org. And sometime in May, the site sort of disappeared. It just kind of fell offline. You could go, I think, if I recall correctly, to the domain, but there was nothing there. And this went on for a couple of weeks. Now, this had happened before. This wasn't something that was completely new. This had happened in the past, so you just kind of assume that, okay, well, it'll come back online. It'll get fixed. There's something unexpected happened. An update went wrong, or someone went in and screwed something up, and you just need to revert the code base, and it'll be back. But this time, it didn't come back. It was gone. OpenClipArt.org was a website for free SVG clip art, really, and clip art is a pretty broad definition. I think most of us think of clip art as those funny little things that you find on those old CD-ROM collections, like six CD-ROMs full of 3,000 clip arts, and you open it up, and they've got the obligatory holidays. They've got all the trees and the hearts and the pumpkins and things like that. And then they've got the other CD of all the business stuff, and you've got all the obligatory office life kinds of things. People buy the water cooler, people buy the coffee maker, a coffee maker, and so on. And then you've got your sports desk, and the collections that I'm talking about. You can still find them sometimes if you go to a thrift store and look in their computer section. They'll inevitably have some collection of free clip art, royalty-free clip art. And I think probably other things shipped with clip art as well, like office suites and things like that, or design applications like desktop publishing things. They always came with clip art. So I think, in a way, a lot of us think of clip art as that little cheesy iconography for commonly required communications of any sort, whether it's a relationship in your life, or office life, or a thing that you're trying to broadcast to other people around the neighborhood. Clip art. Open clip art became a lot more than that, though. I mean, you open a site to the internet and say submit artwork, then you're obviously bound to get a lot of other stuff. And a lot of other stuff it did get, and I used to use it all the time. The card game, I designed a card game at one point. No, I shouldn't say that. Sorry, I re-implemented a card game. It was by Kenneth Rahman, and it was called Dark Cults. It's from the 80s. I think I've talked about it, I think, on Hacker Public Radio. don't think I've mentioned it here, but and I won't go into the specifics. It's a great little game. I probably need to look at the build system again because I think that the build system's a little bit messed up. But it's a print and play because it's someone else's stuff. I can't, sell it or sell copies of it, but I can distribute a re-implementation of it for free. So if you go to GitLab, you'll find it. It's called my version of it is called Dark Occult, and all the cards from the original game from the 80s. It was art by the creator of the game, Kenneth Rahman. But my version, I couldn't, once again, I couldn't just use someone else's copywritten art. So for my version, I just found similarly styled art on OpenClipArt and used that for, 106 cards or whatever it is. And that's just the beginning. But I've used OpenClipArt for all manner of things, really. So it was, and I've submitted quite a lot of artwork to OpenClipArt as well. So it was kind of something that I kind of felt that I think I'd gotten introduced to it in the first place by the Fedora project. And is a lot of the art team on Fedora project had been submitting artwork to OpenClipArt, so I kind of fell into it that way. And so it was something that I figured would always be around. Now, I also figured that it was something that many people maintained. I had the impression, and initially I guess that impression was correct, that many people were behind this website. But as the years wore on, apparently the maintainer of the website sort of forgot to mention to anyone that no one else was maintaining the site. It was literally one person. And this was never made clear to anyone. And so I think that the first lesson to learn from the debacle that I'm describing, which is the loss of openclipart.org, the first lesson is that if you are a maintainer of anything and it is starting to overwhelm you, then say something. Unfortunately, that's not a guarantee that that's going to solve the problem. But if you don't say anything, then it's definitely not going to solve any problems. So say something. This relates to something that I realized many, many episodes ago now, seasons ago, when the, well, it was, I remember it, I think to this day, it was DistroWatch, the website DistroWatch had a podcast that was being done by a community member of DistroWatch. And he would go through and read the news and sort of the site updates and so on. And I remember way back when, this was way back in like 2010 probably, I used to listen to this show every week whenever it came out. And I just thought, this is such a great service. This is really, really great. And I thought, I should email this host. I think his name was Bruce. I should email him and tell him how much I appreciate this. And every time I thought that, I thought, well, don't be silly. He probably gets 30 emails a day about how great his show is. So I'm not going to add to that noise. It doesn't serve any purpose for me to email him. I'll just continue to listen to the show. And sure enough, at some point, again, probably this is probably back in 2010 or 2011 or something, at some point, maybe even earlier, at some point, he stopped making the show. And wouldn't you know, at the very last episode, the day he signed off, he said, specifically, that he wasn't really sure anyone was listening to it or getting anything out of it. Boy, didn't I feel silly. That hurt a lot, and it taught me a lesson, and it taught me that if you appreciate something, you should tell someone that you appreciate it. And similarly, if you're the maintainer of something and you need help, then you should broadcast that you need help. So both sides of the fence. If there's something that you need, then you kind of owe it to the other side to mention it. Now, again, there's no guarantee that that's going to resolve anything. It doesn't mean that just because you put up your hand and say, hey, I'm kind of drowning here, that anyone's going to throw you a life saver, whatever they're called, the thing that the float thing. It just, that's sadly, that's not necessarily how things work. Not because people don't care, but maybe because you're just not reaching the number of people that you need to reach to get that response. Or maybe, whatever. Maybe someone is listening, but they don't feel like they have the skills or the ability to help you in any way. So it just kind of, it depends, but at least mention it. So that's lesson zero, I guess. Communicate. OpenClipArt.org disappeared. It was down for several months. Rumors started to surface about why it was gone. There were a lot of different stories being told about it. some from the same source, so conflicting stories from the same source. For instance, some people claimed that it was a denial of service attack. Someone else claimed, or there was another claim made that there had been an identity theft happening. There was another claim that actually nothing was wrong at all, and just some technical maintenance was underway. There were a lot of different. It's very unclear to this day, really, what exactly happened. And as of this recording, there is sort of a this sort of front page on openclipart.org saying that it is in maintenance mode and protected, and that they welcome love and sharing of clipart. And then there's this donate button to so that you can donate to the project, although there's not really any indication of what kind of level of support they need to get things back online. So there's no goal. It's just this sort of hole that you can shovel money into if you feel like it. And I think that there's an implication here that if you donate, you get access to the site, and that's incorrect. So that's kind of confusing. It's sending a lot of confusing messages to people. And then finally, it says show love on Twitter, which is difficult if you don't have a Twitter account, first of all. It also doesn't quite define what love is. It says show love on Twitter. I'm not really sure what that means, to be honest. And then follow at OpenClipArt for updates, and then an email address, love at OpenClipArt.org. So it's very unclear as to what's going on with that site. And at some point, 6 months into the absence of OpenClipArt.org, some people, including Robert, the guy who emailed me earlier, that I read the email from earlier in the show, some people decided to start looking for other options. Now, I myself attempted one of the to create an alternative. I discovered through some other people that you could scrape OpenClipArt. So initially, I scraped OpenClipArt by scraping archive.org. And that rendered about 17,000 images, which was good, but OpenClipArt.org claimed that they had over 100,000 images. So a 17% success rate was pretty dismal. Now, technically speaking, it was a lot more than that, but I didn't know it at that time, and you'll see what I mean momentarily. So eventually, it came out that you could actually scrape OpenClipArt.org, provided that you knew the direct URLs of the clip art that you are scraping. And so I realized that there was the ability to just do a wget mirror of the directory containing all of the images, and that seemed to work pretty well. And I got 100,000 images. Turned out that 45,000 of those images were all the Open Clip Art logo. That's all it is. So their claim of having 100,000 clip art images was a little bit inflated because 45,000 of those images were the same image. So in the end, it's about 55,000 images that I was able to scrape from openclipart.org. And I posted it into a GitLab repository, which isn't a really great way to distribute these things. And a lot of people said, oh, why don't you just package them up as a torrent and distribute them that way? But that's not really the goal, just to get the images distributed. That's not the goal. The larger goal here is to create a community around which people can continue to contribute clip art. That's a key part of the appeal of Open Clip Art, was that people could submit their stuff and then other people could use them. And it was CC0, Creative Commons zero license, so you could use it for just anything without, with or without credit. And that's exciting, and that's kind of what we want, is this community to be able to form around a website offering free images. So my attempt was, while good intentioned, I don't think it was quite sufficient for what we were looking for. It would require really people to be savvy with Git or GitLab at least. But it would require them to have a GitLab account and then to submit an artwork. It would really require them to fork the entire repository, post an image, and then do a pull request. It's a really clunky, it would be a clunky system that I felt would be really difficult to sell to people. And then the browsing ability is not great either, right? You can sort of search for images, and it comes up with some strings if the metadata of the image is correct, and if or it present rather, and so it could work. And, if you were looking for a pumpkin image, you could search for pumpkin, and as long as the image was either named pumpkin or had metadata containing the word pumpkin, then you're good. But otherwise, you're not going to come up with that image. So it's a little bit clunky, and ultimately, it wasn't the right answer. However, Robert, the guy whose email I read at the beginning of the show, got into contact with the maintainers of public domain vectors, and apparently they were keen to sort of fill this sudden gap that had come about. And fill it they did. They created a site called freesvg.org based on the Laravel PHP framework, which provides them with sort of an admin dashboard for users and user accounts and that sort of thing. And they uploaded a bunch of images. I don't know that they have the full 55,000 up yet, or if they are even using that as their source. I've contacted them, but I'm not super clear on what the source of the images has been. But they've got those uploaded, some number uploaded, and they've got search functionality there. They're tagging all the images, and they've got user creation, user accounts that you can sign up with, and it's basically all the same stuff. It's Creative Commons licensed, specifically SVG format. The advantage to SVG, obvious or not, maybe not obviously, is that it is an open source format. It's an open specification, scalable vector graphics. It's quite popular for web stuff, but it's also great for just infinitely scalable graphics that you're designing for posters or green cards. And when I say infinitely scalable, I mean you draw the artwork that you want to draw, and then you can make that as small or as large. You can make it print crystal clear, like it'll be perfectly as clear whether you print it on a 32 foot by 32 foot mega poster or you print it on a little greeting card. Doesn't matter because it's all math. The curves and the lines and the colors, the fills and everything they're calculated by the computer as it is being rendered, rather than, for instance, a bitmap, which is just pixels on a very precise in very exact places. So if you try to upscale, up-res pixel art, obviously you have to start adding pixels because there were only 8 pixels there before, and now you want there to be 32. Well, those 32 pixels have to come from somewhere, and the place that they come from is by adding more pixels, which usually a computer does for you because otherwise you would be doing it yourself. And it tends to degrade things noticeably. Vector art doesn't have that disadvantage. So freesvg.org is the new open clip art. I highly recommend kind of broadcasting that out, letting people know about it. It's a great resource. It's a great resource for everybody. I mean, whether you're a game designer, a teacher, a graphic artist, a computer programmer who needs an icon set for something that they're doing, whatever it might be, this is a fantastic resource. Everything's basically public domain. It's not public domain, it's CC0, which in many countries is like public domain. So you don't have to credit the artist if you don't find that convenient. You can modify anything that you find there. You don't have to return your modifications. It's something that you can download, and you can do whatever you want to with the clip art. It's a really great resource for anyone who needs a little bit of artwork for any purpose. The site is advertisement supported. There are ads on the site. The site uses, I mean, like the ads are, at least right now, obviously I can't guarantee anything for the future. I don't know these people, but right now the ads are sensible ads. In other words, you're on a free SVG site looking at vector images. The ads that show up on the site are from Shutterstock from their vector division, and I think I've seen other companies as well. But in other words, the ads make sense. They're not like sleazy ads that aren't work safe or anything like that. It's stuff that you could look at and you can think, yeah, I can see why that would be on this page. Is it enjoyable to see an ad on a page? Well, no, not really. I mean, it's kind of a bother. It gets confusing because you do a search for some image, and then you see your image, and then you see Shutterstock images, and then you see suggested images from the or related images from elsewhere on the site. So, if you're in a hurry or if you're not super familiar with the internet, I guess you might think, oh, well, here's more results, and I like that one on Shutterstock a lot. You might click that link, and then it takes you off to Shutterstock, where maybe you're expected to pay some amount of money. So that kind of seems confusing that you would have gone to freesvg.org only to go to a place that wants you to create a separate account and then pay for these other images that you found. That could be annoying. But at the same time, it kind of, I mean, it makes sense, right? I mean, these guys put effort into building the website. They filled a gap for something that fell over, that was not able to sustain itself, and they're trying to ensure that their site can do better, can sustain itself in some way. Would it be nicer, maybe, I don't know, to have a Patreon account so people can voluntarily contribute, blah blah blah. Yeah, maybe, but then again, there's no guarantee as to whether they're going to get supporters. So yeah, ads it is on freesvg.org. Nevertheless, freesvg.org is a great resource. I'm going to be using it a lot. I'm going to be contributing to it a lot. And I encourage you to take a look at it if that's something that you have a need for. So lesson zero was to communicate. If you're a maintainer or if you're a community member, communicate with each other. Let each other know what's going on. If you're drowning, make that known. If you have resources that you can contribute, make that known, and so on. No one may help. No one may take you up on an offer, but at least you've communicated it. Lesson one, I think, is that ownership of communal property, of communal content, is really, really important. If the community doesn't own the thing that they are helping to build, then I think that the openness of that thing could fairly be questioned. Open clip art was called open clip art, and there's that word in there, open. And I've talked about this in the past and very recently, just that word open, how there's an implication to it. It means something, and yet it doesn't really mean anything exactly. So open clip art could easily be called open because anyone could submit to it. It could put art on it. And really, there was no curation, so it was open. There was an open door policy. You create your account, you put your artwork on it, and that's it. There's not really a whole lot of curation going on. There's no barrier to entry. There's no qualification. You just do the thing, and you're on. However, the impression that many people were sort of controlling the site, the governance, I guess, was not open. There was no transparency into how the site was run or how the site was being maintained or how it was being kept online at all, where the money was coming from, and so on. So that was kind of problematic, and I think lesson one would be, if you're in a community and you care about the thing that you're contributing to, find out more. Find out what their governance policy is, who's in charge, who could shut the thing down due to a bad day, especially if you're relying on something for business and for getting things done. You owe it to yourself to really understand how that thing works, which of course is the big argument for open source in the first place, right? We're all sitting here using open source and saying it's great because largely because we like to know how things work. So if the sites that you're relying on are sites that you don't really know anything about, you don't have any right to really rely on it at all. And that's inconvenient because not all sites want you to necessarily be involved. I mean, there's not really any call for being involved in the website if they're not offering that. So it can be somewhat inconvenient sometimes. But I think we need to have the realization that if the governance and if the maintenance of a resource is not itself open and communal, then you cannot justifiably depend on it. And the fact that open clip art itself went away and no one had the artwork backed up, I mean, that's such a That should have never happened, really. Someone should have been making backups of all that artwork, because for the site to go away and everyone to then have to sort of email each other frantically and ask, hey, do you have that chunk of 10,000 images that I don't have, or that chunk of 90,000 images that I don't have? That's not good. You're obviously throwing all of your eggs into that one basket, and you don't know how the basket is put together. So that's an important lesson, I think. And then if I had to come up with another lesson, lesson two would be that if you're in a community that is formed around something other than the community itself, then you need to ensure that the community has channels by which they can communicate external of the project. That it's one of those things that I feel like most of us have learned in a very casual way. For instance, when you're in school, you talk to your friends at school, and maybe some friends you also communicate with after school. But you know that there's that difference. There are your friends in real life, the ones that you hang out with in the neighborhood, and then there are your friends who you only see at school. And when you change schools, when you graduate from primary school to junior high school or intermediate school or whatever, maybe your set of friends changes because, I mean, unless you're in a small town, in which case it never changes. But let's say that that happens. Some people go to a different district or whatever, so your friends change. And so somehow we all know very early on that there are situations that kind of encourage or that create friendships. But those friendships aren't necessarily, they're not external of that situation. And we see that again at work and so on. You see this throughout real life, where people are really only sort of available to you under certain circumstances. And the same goes for the online stuff. There are people that you communicate with and you deal with only through one means of communication. And then if that means of communication goes away, then you suddenly realize just how unconnected you actually were. You feel very connected as long as that resource is there, but once it's taken away, then suddenly you realize none of you had each other's information. You have no idea how to contact one another. And then you're kind of wandering around the internet trying to find some semblance of that Nick. And is it the same person, or is it a different person with the same handle? Really kind of difficult to figure that out sometimes, and not very efficient. So if you're doing a community project, you don't necessarily have to exchange email addresses, I guess, but at least have some means by which you can communicate with one another when that service goes down, when it goes away, when someone crazy steps into place and starts doing things that none of you agree with. It's important to have that ability to, well, it's a union, really. That's kind of what I'm talking about. Internet users need to unionize. They need to form groups external to the projects that they're working on. It's an important thing that a lot of us don't think about, but it needs to happen. It needs to exist. Or you lose your community when something happens, when something bad happens. And that could happen. That's totally, and if you're okay with that, then that's fine too. But if you're not okay with that, then make sure that you've got those external channels happening. And that's pretty much what I've learned from the disaster that openclipart.org ended up being. But what it built and its legacy lives on, and that's at freesvg.org. You should check it out. You should contribute if you're an artist. You should use the art if you need art. It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of great stuff created primarily with Inkscape, some probably other tools that generate SVGs, but it's a good site, so check it out. That's all I have for you this week. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next time. Thank you for listening to the GNU World Order Podcast. This has been Klaatu. You can reach me on IRC. I'm on the Freenode network, usually in channels such as Augcast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of others. My nick on IRC is not Klaatu. You can also reach me lately on Mastodon. My username there is @klaatu@mastodon.xyz. Of course, you can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's klaatu@member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And of course, you can visit my various websites, newworldorder.info and slackermedia.info. I will see you next time.